Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to the Casey Catch Up. Epic chat with Casper Steinfath. We went through his Kattegat journey, which was literally he paddled from Denmark to Sweden over 120 kilometers, and we unpacked how that adventure was. We also went into a lot of stuff on reading the bumps and the best way to learn, how to train for a big journey like he did. And all in all, it was a great chat with Casper. If you're enjoying these videos or listening along, make sure you follow or subscribe. Follow on Spotify, subscribe on YouTube. And if you are interested in learning to downwind, supfoil, be sure to get in touch with me. Email me at info@caseyaus.com and we can get you started. Enjoy the chat and plenty more episodes coming. All right, guys, welcome to the Casey Catch Up. I'm super excited to have Casper Steinfath. We're just catching up. We haven't seen each other or had a good proper catch up for seems like we did the math. It's like 8 years since our like
It's been
proper
8 years. That's
catch up.
nuts.
We've seen each other a lot, competition events, but he's always busy. He's the oh, when I've been in Denmark, he's been the local hero, and I've been the enemy coming in and trying to steal the gold, so to speak. So it's been really good. I'm really looking forward to this chat with Casper. And I kind of want to break this up into two things. The first thing is his Viking crossing. It's Casper downwind foiled 120 Ks from Denmark to Sweden in, I'm going to put it lightly, less than ideal conditions. So we're going to unpack that. And then we're going to go into, I guess, his background in foiling. But Casper, let's get straight into it. Viking Crossing 3.0. What was the mission? And I want to hear all the roller coaster, the whole thing.
I mean, it's funny. It feels kind of full circle right now catching up with you, James, because I mean, we'll get into that later, but we've kind of mirrored each other along a long part of the way, even though we've been on completely different sides of the world. But
Opposites.
the Viking Crossing 3.0 was essentially in the later years, I've got this like addiction to adventure and like you doing my own types of projects outside the realm of competition. And living in Denmark, we're basically surrounded by water. And you have oceans on each side. And like, I just have this fascination of backtracking the Vikings' footsteps. They sailed all these amazing places. So a couple of years ago, I paddled on my SUP across to Norway. This time, I wanted to foil between Denmark and Sweden over the legendary Nordic Ocean of Kattegat. And you might have heard that name in like the series Vikings. That's Kattegat is a legendary Viking myth, but it's also an ocean. And I figured, it's roughly 120 kilometers long. And I just had this, since I got into foiling, I was basically just dreaming of doing a downwind across this strait because the winds can be really good. But as you know, any type of adventure, you might start off with a vision of how it's going to be epic and just a lot of fun. Like most things in life, it kind of takes a turn at some point, and it turned into a pretty good hard style adventure with everything from epic downwind to no wind to currents pulling me around, and basically it was just the Viking Crossing is my saga that I'm working on.
Unreal. I've been loving following it. And like you said, we're like sort of Casper and I are both multidisciplinary SUP. Racing is kind of the main thing, but I think we both started SUP surfing before we got into SUP racing. And the foiling has been an extension of that. And it's been really, literally opposite ends of the world. Like you're in Denmark, we're 12 hours
Yeah.
apart or something like that. And I actually spoke to you, Casper, about Marcus Tardew and I did the foil for the fires, which is 100 kilometers. And we did this, we had like a waiting period and it didn't look as official as yours. I'm like calling Marcus, like, where's the wind look like? But I love that. I love the organization stuff you went through for your 3.0 crossing because you need certain conditions. And I guess let everyone know what, so 120 Ks, I just want to make this clear to everyone, 120 Ks, even if it says it's going to be a windy day, over 120 kilometers, the conditions change like a lot.
Yes.
Like, a shitload. Like it's ups and downs, and no matter what sort of body, even if you're in the same spot for a whole day, the conditions change a lot. But when you stretch it out over, you know, an entire ocean between countries,
yeah, there's so much variation, like in that the distance and that time span. And I think, like, I mean, you make my Viking crossing sound glorious. I mean, because you know, in reality, the organization of it is just like, yeah, you know, you're calling up people and it's stressful, and the inside the machine room, it is always another hectic level. But I think, like, when I got into downwind foiling, like, it just also, you know, it became this new world for me that opened up. And like seeing you do the 120K downwind in Australia also kind of opened my mind to like, oh, maybe it is actually possible, because, you know, around these latitudes where I am, like, people have a whole different perspective of water. And like, you know, it's only in the very recent years that people started playing in the water, where it was viewed as this, you know, gnarly workspace for fishermen that were just battling the, you know, the elements of trying to, you know, bring food to the table. So it's so interesting to try to, you know, break ground where people have not done it before. That was kind of my motivation for it as well.
And just on that, for guys that are watching or listening, Casper lives in Denmark. And if you haven't heard of Denmark, it's basically, it's the southern part of Scandinavia, so to speak, northern part of Europe. You're basically in the Arctic Circle. Casper paddled and trains in the snow. I went to Denmark, his hometown, in the middle of summer. And Casper was like, oh, no, you missed it. Summer was like a week ago. You know, it was literally that, like, the middle, we're in the middle of winter here. And it was probably a warmer day here than it was where you are. Although maybe you're not in Denmark at the moment.
Well, I'm sitting in Denmark right now. Just, you know, I got a t-shirt on, so it's pretty, you know, it's fairly warm.
That's why I doubted it. It must be the day of summer.
But that's the beauty of Denmark. Like, for those that have never been to these latitudes, you know, Denmark is Northern Europe. It's, I mean, for me, it's just home. It's here that I grew up and, you know, was introduced to water sports and surfing initially. And it's, you know, it has a charm in itself that there are so many seasons. The weather keeps changing, and you know, you never really know what you're going to get. Even summer might not show up because it, you know, the winds just don't bring the hot air up here. But I mean, it has a lot of other things. And I think if you come from Denmark, you can go anywhere in the world and be positively surprised.
And probably surf in board shorts.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was cold to say the least when we were in Denmark, and I had a great time. I loved it. I loved the hospitality you guys put on, and it was good to catch up with you in your hometown, albeit with the ISA event going on. But yeah, it was unreal and very different to where most people do their water sports, I would say.
We're not blessed with warm conditions like Australia, but you know, we can still have fun up here. I guess that's the way we look at it. And like, you know, growing up in Denmark, we were kind of an underdog nation. Like, I remember when we went to all the APP World Tour events, and remember Rocky Cannon, the announcer, Rocky would always be like, and from the great surfing nation of Denmark, we have Casper, which, you know, is just so ironic in one sense. But it's, I think it's fun to kind of be the underdog.
Yeah, absolutely. See, I'm going to steer us back towards the 3.0. We got to get distracted all the time.
Yeah, sorry.
Gear the ship. Conditions. So tell me what conditions you were waiting for in your waiting period and what conditions materialized. And then talk us through the equipment that you were, I know, like, foil size and the choice of your foil is such a big decision from when you're learning to when you're doing, as you get better, you've got more options. And you always... personally, you're always looking for that faster option, but for the longer stuff, you know, tell us what your parameters were and what you went with.
Well, I mean, essentially, I mean, this is a long one, but when preparing for the crossing, like, I, you know, I had eyed this project for a while, since somewhere in the middle of last year, I'd kind of eyed, I wanted to do this crossing on a foil. but there was so much information I needed to get. And like, I needed to find out, you know, how to even approach a project like this. How do you foil 120 kilometers? Like, and it's open ocean, like you're not hugging the coast at all during this. So it was a massive project. And, you know, I spent a lot of time testing equipment, trying to find out, you know, first of all, what weather conditions could I expect? Because in this part of the world, we don't have stable trade winds. We have gnarly, moody low pressures that just, you know, come slamming across Northern Europe. They're usually, that means you can have very strong winds, you can have no winds, but everything is ever changing. So I spent a lot of time analyzing weather patterns, like statistically, what could I expect if, say, I had a 4 or 6 week waiting period. And so I dug into, you know, that was a fun process, you know, understanding what, you know, it's kind of like understanding your dance partner, like what is she capable of? Mm. And then I tested a lot, like I figured that I could expect, you know, weather windows of maybe 10 to 15 hours of you know, ideal wind. But then again, like you never know. So I started preparing for everything. And like, I tested a bunch of equipment tested different foil boards, tested different foil wings, masts, setups to find out, as you said before, like, you know, if we were going out in perfect conditions, it's pretty clear that we'd pick, you know, the nicest foil, the fastest foil, just to race. But here I was more thinking of myself as like, you know, I'm not a Ferrari, I'm not a Formula One car. I have to think of myself as like a diesel engine, essentially just slowly but steadily moving forward. And that's what I've learned from my previous ocean crossings, is it's not a game of speed, it's a game of staying in the game, so to say.
Yeah.
But anyways, like the project materialized during last year, and especially, you know, since COVID shut down so much of our regular competitive platform with stand-up paddling, well, I kind of figured like, hey, this is a great opportunity for me to do some of my own projects, and this was one of them. So at the beginning of 2021, I kind of just went into this mode of like if you ask my girlfriend or anyone around me, like I think I just became obsessed with looking at weather charts, dialing my foil setup, just for this one purpose of adventure. And and then it began.
And just on that low pressure system, it's like I've done a bit of forecasting. They're the hardest to predict. And like,
yeah,
you know, 15 hours of good wind, like one model update, as you would have noticed, and all of a sudden your low pressure was here and it's here. And that means the winds are going this way instead of this way, which, you know, for a crossing and like forecasting winds for a crossing is ridiculous. Like it's so hard. But let's dive into, like, I guess for me, what Marcus and I were looking for was just windy conditions, steady, the same direction for the whole time. On the East Coast, when I did my Wollongong to Sydney, 120K, we had a really good southerly. Again, it was a cold front, so I was moving up the coast, but up the coast, right, it's pretty steady. I was looking for swell that was sort of more south-southwest, so going past the coast rather than southeast going into the coast, because our coastline kind of faces east-southeast. So a south swell moves a little bit in and a southwest swell kind of goes past. And that's in theory, but all swells wrap towards land. The bigger the swell, the more that swell wraps in. So I found I went in a big swell because the wind was good, but the swell was also big. So with the wind being strong, it saved me. But if it was the swell that was wrapping in and then rebounding off, it made some stretches of my journey much harder.
So you were fighting, is it right that you were fighting to not end up back on shore?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the swell, if I was to follow the swells, they would have taken me basically onshore, like onto the land about 35, 40 Ks into my crossing. So I was always hunting out to sea. And at times, with a steep cliff, I was rebounding off cliff, backwash, and going back out to sea. I was 1 or 2 kilometers offshore, but the refraction and the rebound was all going on. you were fighting something completely different in that you're out in the middle of the ocean, and that brings with it its own challenges. And so, like, condition-wise, were you looking for just a strong wind, or, you know, do swell, like ground swells form in that ocean? I wouldn't think so.
No, so, I mean, the ocean of Kattegat, like, it's basically, look at it, it's kind of like a bottleneck. It's like between Denmark and Sweden, it kind of is this weird angled coastlines. And the Fetch is really only like 100, 150 kilometers wide at the longest. So you're not going to get any real, you know, powerful swell. You're still dealing with, you know, the chops and swell generated inside the Fetch, which is very storm characteristic. The waves are very close to each other. They are very, you know, erratic. There might be like all kinds of different components depending on how the wind shifts. So basically the weeks prior to the crossing, I was just like a madman looking at forecasts, and my ideal forecast was like a southwest wind. Oh, you're showing me a map. Oh, there's a map. Great.
I've got a map. I want to show everyone. Yeah. So where did you start? Just so we can sort of really piece it together. Because this is, I love this stuff. Like this is.
Yeah. So you see that in Denmark, there's those two cities called Aarhus and Randers. Between that headland you're hovering over just above where your cursor is now.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I started. Mm-hmm. In the city of Grenå. It's an old industrial port. You just leave it there, like where the cursor is now. Like that's the one. That's the one. So I started from the most eastern point there, and then set a northeast course up towards the island of Anholt first. And then I continued further north just to, or northeast to the city of Varberg in Sweden. So that's kind of like, if you look at it in a straight line, that's Varberg. In a straight line, that's, you know, you need a wind from the southwest. You need swell from the southwest. That's your ideal condition. But the problem is, you know, like you said before, forecasting low pressures, like you're just essentially waiting for the storm. Mm-hmm. And we had like 4 weeks of being on standby with, you know, my boat crew and my media team. And it was just a mess, you know, like looking at forecasts, like it's kind of like chasing storms. Like you'll see a storm materializing 7 days out in the forecast. Then by the time you get to the 4 day window, which was kind of our cutoff, many times it would just completely drop. Actually the one that we ended up activating, like the actual storm for the project, was a nice low pressure that came off England. And it gave us, you know, came through with wind, like the wind speed, because I didn't really look at swell size. I was more concerned about the wind speed and how that correlated to small waves being created. But the wind speed I was looking for was somewhere between 10 meters a second and 12 meters a second, which is, you know, just over 20 knots. I was also experimenting with like foiling in, you know, 15 knots, 12 knots. And you can do it, but you know, when you get to that level, it's just brutal. It's not really enjoyable.
Especially without any ground swell. I think, you know, in Australia on the East Coast, we get, you know, if it's a south swell, the swell's literally going along the coast. So it'd be like being, you know, here, and you're foiling up the coast, and there's all this sort of fetch.
Didn't I send you an Instagram message asking like, what's the lowest in the wind spectrum you have foiled?
Yeah,
and you said something ridiculous like, how can I thought, how can that work? But then you also said like, it's not enjoyable.
Yeah, I think you're asking like, what's the lightest I've downwind foiled in, and it was a bad question to ask for me, because conditions make such a big difference. This is one of the things that everyone learning to foil should think about, is that, you know, 20 knots here in Sydney, Australia, is like, that's heaps of wind, because you have normally the wind and the fetch has come all the way along the coast, and that wind's following you. So you have like this mid-period swell as well as the wind. So sometimes in a southerly, it only gets to 10, like a southerly front will come through and the, you know, the peak of the wind will be like 20 knots, but it'll drop to 10 knots really quickly. And I can get out in, I'll use the same foil, like the P&L 185 in 10 knots, but there's all this residual bump that I'm actually tapping into. The wind swell, I'm not actually using a lot of. So basically what you're doing, Casper, like in this mission, it's kind of more like, it'd kind of be like foiling in like a harbor or like a estuary, not taking away.
Yeah.
Just because there's no ground swell, it's all generated by shorter period wind swell, so to speak.
Yeah. It's all, it all comes from scratch. Like it has to be built up from scratch essentially.
So,
and that was, you know, that was, how do I say it? Like that was the problem as well. That was why I never, that was why it got so demanding, because I was dealing with really small, short period stuff.
Yeah. So I guess when you asked me that question, I wish I'd clarified, because if I, you know, I foiled in 30 knots in like a bay, so to speak, and this is bigger than a bay. It's 100 kilometers wide. There'll be some fetch. There'll be some pretty decent mid-period stuff towards the end if the wind was to continue to flow. But when I do like we've got a stretch of water called Pittwater, and it's Hawkesbury River. And when I'm in that stretch of water, I could literally foil on the ocean side on my, you know, P&L 185 or like the GL 180 kind of size wing. And then I'll go to the harbor side. And if I use the same foil in the exact same wind, I am pumping and paddling the entire time. And what I normally do is I put a much bigger wing on that's slower and liftier, and I'll glide and go almost, you know, two thirds of the speed.
Yeah.
But actually enjoy it because I'm not having to pump. Whereas on the same foil I'm using the ocean, I'm pumping and paddling and like, because there's nothing else. I'm going faster than everything else around me. Whereas in just wind chop, I find using a bigger foil allows more fun. Yes, you're going slower.
Yeah.
Because the wind chop, you actually get energy from the wind chop, it helps you. Whereas if you're going fast and everything, it's a nightmare. Like you're...
No, then you're fighting the chop. Then you're not really even using it.
Exactly. Yeah. So like I would imagine from the get-go, I guess you would have a little bit of wind coming off the land, but that start would have been tricky. I didn't see the very start of your mission.
Let's take it from the start, because basically where I started, it was like the wind did not come in the direction it was forecast. Like the low pressure kind of came in at a different angle. So what should ideally have been a southwest wind came in as like a south, maybe south southwest. So
too far up the coast.
Yeah. So it was basically just going to send me north. So when I came paddling out of the harbor there, you know, it's a long harbor I had to paddle out of. So it was kind of like, I felt like a 747, you know, just taxiing away from the gate, going to the runway. Then once I got clear of the harbor wall, everything was kind of already hitting me from the side. Like there was already swell because if you look on the map, there's plenty of open space south of the harbor.
Yeah.
It created plenty of swell, but everything was kind of sending me straight towards that headland, just north of the harbor. Like it didn't even look like I was going to clear that. So all the people in my following boat, like they were, including myself on the foil, we were thinking like, shit, this is going to end before it even starts. Like we're not even going to get away from land.
Yeah.
But basically I got going, and you know, the bumps were solid enough that I could get the foil up, but then it became clear to me from that moment that this is not going to be an epic downwinder. This is going to be somewhat like a sidewinder, you know, just bottom turning right the whole way.
Which is your backhand, which makes it even harder.
Yeah, I mean, like the joke was like, oh, I did like 2,000 bottom turns backside the whole way, trying to get to Sweden.
Yeah.
But the waves were actually okay. Like the wind was blowing, I'd say somewhat, it was like north of 20 knots And the bumps were materializing really quick.
Yeah.
And I was able to hold a course, which was, you know, probably around 30 degrees away from the wind, like, you know, cutting 30 degrees away, which on a foil I had found out previously was possible. But there's a difference between testing, you know, for 10 minutes, if I can hold 30 degrees, and doing it for 10 hours. That was the conclusion.
Oh, for sure. So I might just sort of draw. So basically the wind was coming this direction and you wanted it to be going this direction.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, so exactly.
As you can see, like on a SUP, you'd almost abandon completely if that was the case, because that's just blowing you up to this island here. On a foil, because of the flexibility we have, you can make it work. But as you said, it's not ideal.
No. But I mean, it made it that more challenging as well, because it was not impossible. And I mean, at times, like, it actually was enjoyable as well, because the bumps were really good and they had speed. And it kind of reminded me of, like, you ever remember doing the Gorge paddle challenge?
Yeah.
Like the bumps were similar to that, like really steep, and you know, they were short lived, but they were just, man, it was epic. Like there's, you maybe saw that clip of when I passed the wind farms in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Like that was fucking incredible. Just flying like full speed on the foil and just like zigzagging between these huge structures. And like at that point, it actually, that was only like 3 hours in and I was still fairly, you know, composed and strong.
Yeah.
But I felt like a kid in a candy store. And that was, that was the hype.
And that's, for me. That's like the dream. Like when I, you know, dreamed up my vision of foiling 100Ks, 120Ks, I'm like, this is going to be epic. Like, you know, 15Ks isn't long enough. Let's go 100. Let's see how far we can go. And conditions are going to be awesome. And we're just going to be surfing the whole time.
Right. Right.
Yeah. For the first 3 hours. It's like, yeah, this is epic. This is unreal. And then as you progress and have to overcome a few hurdles, it becomes a couple second thoughts sort of creep into your mind. You know, was this a good idea, James? Yeah. Was this a good idea, Casper? The wind stopped, or there's seaweed, or the foil I chose, or whatever it is.
It was, it definitely crossed my mind a couple of times. Like, Casper, why the hell are you doing this? But that, it was definitely not the time to ask why. When you're in the middle of it, you just got to do it.
Yeah, too far gone. And, you know, the fact that you've started, you keep going. And actually, for those guys that are using, you know, the Nash foil gear and the frothers that were, you know, that just want to know what you're using, what length, first of all, what length mast were you using? What size board and what size front and back wing?
Yeah, so I did a lot of testing prior to the trip, and I tested big wings, small wings, big masts, low masts. And like, I found out like my ideal mast was around 85 centimeters. Mm-hmm. That was just, you know, to make sure that you don't bridge between chops. It's just so much more enjoyable with a bigger mast.
Yeah.
I used I think it was an 85 liter Nash Hover, which is one of the standard SUP, smaller SUP boards, but it's still, I mean, it's, for me, it was enough. Like, I'm 73 kilos and like proportionally it allowed me to get up fairly easy.
What are the dimensions on that? Because that's something that I found is, anyway, what were the dimensions?
Yeah, I think it's 5'3" or 5'6". And then it's fairly boxy in its outline. It's one of those, you know, kind of, they've gone more round now, but it had a really square tail, huge. I forget the actual width on it, but I want to say it's somewhere around, you know, also 25 or something, 26 inches wide.
So that, to me, just listening to the dimensions, to me, that'd be hard to get going. And just for those guys that don't know, Casper's a world champion sprint paddler, basically. Like, you've made a name for yourself in the SUP world as a, like, basically a specialist sprinter.
Yeah.
So like, for someone who can paddle up, if anyone's going to be able to paddle up a 5'3" or a small foil or whatever it is,
yeah,
it's going to be your man.
Well, and I'm going to admit that, yeah, like, I love the challenge of trying to make it fly. I think that might have been how do I say it? I was maybe slightly over optimistic about the equipment I used, because maybe we should jump to the actual foil I used. I used the Nash 1400 high aspect jet.
That's pretty small.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say that.
Yeah. I don't know the size of Nash, but I know that I've tried JB's gear a couple of times, and I don't know exactly how it correlates, because GoFoil don't say sizes, so I don't know what is what. But
yeah, I mean, the 1400 is kind of my, it's not even my go-to. My go-to is the 1240, which, and I don't know what it relates to in other foils, but it's, they're good for waves. The 1240 is good for surfing and like high intensity downwinders. So I figured the 1400 was my go-to, it was a little bit bigger and it would carry me. But I paired it with a 320 stabilizer. And again, like that was my learning from this whole project. There really is a big difference between trying to use a certain set of equipment for an hour or 2 hours versus, you know, the longevity of a 10-hour expedition, because your body is strong and explosive in the beginning.
Yeah.
Whereas when you get past that halfway mark or something, you're going into zombie mode and you just don't have the same power to get going. So in hindsight, like once I was up and riding, great. But my biggest problem was exactly that, getting up and riding once I got tired.
Yeah. So 85 centimeter mass is exactly what I use. I find it's that sweet spot. I'm not sure if you've tried longer, but longer for me gets a little bit heavier, or there's something that doesn't quite fit. 85 seems like it's just like spot on. 1400, I should have done my research to see what size that is, but I feel like that's a little bit smaller than what I would generally use. And for a longer journey, like I've got within the GoFoil range, there's the PNL 185, which is like this really high aspect wing, and it glides really well. It turns like an absolute pig. It's just because it's so high aspect that you turn, the wingtip comes out, and you've almost got a brace for that. And then if I really want to go for a really fast downwinder, I'm using the NL 160 or the NL 190, depending on the sort of swell or wind strength and size. But for sure, like I find when I go smaller, you know, there's the carrot, you know, you dangle the carrot. If it's smaller, you can go faster and then you can finish quicker and it's going to be awesome. But
yeah,
what I found personally was, I was better off going.
Yeah, yeah, but that was exactly the. You go.
The delay is always hard.
Well, I was saying like that was exactly the problem like I was facing as well, because in one sense you just want to like power away and like, you know, ride the, you know, the Formula One car, but then at the other hand, like, yeah, it's just, I don't know if it's something hardwired into us as humans, like we want to get out of those situations as quick as possible.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Like in hindsight, I don't know about your crossing, but your expedition, like, would you have chosen any different equipment? Like in hindsight,
for my one, I would have only gone smaller. The conditions were actually, I got really lucky. The conditions were really good and the swells were massive, so I could have actually used a smaller foil, and I probably could have finished a bit quicker. There was a middle part in my crossing or my journey along the coast that I couldn't go with the swells, or I would basically breach. So I was going with them and pulling off. I mean, going with and pulling off, and I'd only ever go with them for a couple, you know, 1-2 seconds. And I'm like, man, I'm going too fast. I'm going to explode. So I just cut out. And at that moment, I'm like, could have used a smaller foil. You know, that would have been pretty nice. Could have been going quicker. But then for the overall journey, my goal was, you know, speed is one thing, but I always say to people, there's nothing slower than swimming. Yeah. And with a foil, there's nothing slower than not foiling. So if you're not foiling, it's like kind of game over. It's like, oh, all the swells are going past and it's just the worst. So I prefer to, you know, maybe lose half a K per hour or 1K per hour on the entire average, but be up the whole time than having a come down and stress, oh my God, am I going to be able to paddle up again? You know, that's the worst feeling.
Yeah, I recognize that. But I mean, that was... for the last part of my crossing, you know, it turned into exactly that. Like I was literally not foiling because, I mean, I was tired and my legs were shot from lactic acid, you know, just because I had to keep pumping. Like listening to you talk about, like, you were just had to pull out because it was too powerful.
Yeah.
I was at the opposite end of the spectrum. Yeah. Like, fuck, man, I wish there was more power.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I guess, like, I was actually overpowered. So you chose too big a wing. And in hindsight, you know, I would have loved a slightly smaller one, but I was willing to take the risk of bigger foil just for the ease. And just like, I prefer, like, as you said, you're having to pump the whole time. I prefer to just have to get out of there and glide for a little bit and then jump back on than having to paddle and pump and paddle and pump. And because, as you said, like, as you know now, there's nothing worse.
Yeah, exactly. But then the last, like, for me, at least the last, I think 10 kilometers, that was when the wind died and like I could literally see Sweden in front of me. And I just, you know, at that point was kind of over it. And like, just like, I want to be done with this. And but not, you know, that's just out of our control. Like then the wind disappeared and the waves declined. And like, I figured like, okay, I'm not going to foil in. Maybe I should get on the following boat. But then, you know, the athlete comes up and me like, hey, my shoulders and arms are actually okay. So I ended up paddling on my stomach the last 10 kilometers which is
ridiculous. On a 5-3
to wash up. I washed up like next to some nuclear power plant in Sweden. That was, you know, not anticipated, but kind of funny.
Yeah, for sure. Like, man, what a journey. And I guess the highs and lows you must have gone through from, you know, kid in the candy store through the windmills, all this wind, all this swell, just it looks like you were just loving it, surfing, you know, just doing all these turns and there's windmills and there's wind and there's bumps and you're like, yeah. And then fast forward probably another 3 hours and then you're paddling on your stomach with on a 5-3 board with dragging a foil, and, you know, a foil definitely helps create that lift, but the foil is also weight. And when the foil isn't acting as a foil, it's an anchor.
It was the longest 10 kilometers in my life. I'm pretty sure about that. but I mean, the best part of it was like, I got to see my crew on the following boat. You know, they were seasick and, you know, vomiting left and right. And it was,
oh, you're in a better place.
I was in a better place than them. That was my evaluation.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, there were so many ups and downs along the way. And I mean, we were sitting the night before the crossing and my media team on the boat were asking me like, so where are you going to land in Sweden? Like, we have to make sure we position the cameras right. And it's just kind of funny because like them not being used to dealing with, you know, ocean in the same way that I am, I just thought, well, we can't really, like, we can make a guess, but we don't really know what's going to unfold. But that was kind of the fun of it, because then when shit hits the fan and you power through it and you wash up somewhere, it feels, you get that feeling of adventure. And that was what I really loved about the trip, even though I didn't exactly foil all the way, it still felt meaningful.
Yeah, for sure. And what an adventure. I love hearing that, and it's got me all inspired. It's winter for us here now, but the days are a little bit short, but I really want to do something like you've done and go further again and wait for the right day and just send it, you know. So Casper, well, amazing, really inspirational. It blows my mind the distances and the different conditions you went through, literally foiling from one country to another. Maybe I should try to go to New Zealand one day. Which is a little bit further, but I guess that's the equivalent, across the water.
It's a bit further. Well, New Zealand's your neighbor, so you should go say hi to your neighbor. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look at what Chris Burdish is doing, and you know, we're just playing in the kiddies pool. But it's so cool. Everyone doing their own little. The adventure is really what it's all about, and I got super inspired watching you do it, and I'm sure everyone else did as well. And so I'm going to try to do something like you've done, which is That's what when I do stuff, it's what you're always trying to do, inspire others. And that's, you know, so thank you, mate.
Yeah.
I want to backtrack.
Thanks. First of all, right back at you, right back at you, because that thing you did down in Sydney was kind of also what opened my mind. It's like, this is possible, like 100K plus. So right back at you.
Yeah. Cheers, mate. We can keep bouncing off each other. We can see how far we can push it. And maybe one day you can come to my conditions and see what light conditions I foil in compared to your light conditions. And maybe you'll understand.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a little bit easier in my light conditions. But yeah, let's backtrack and go to, I guess, when did you first learn to foil and how was your transition to learning to downwind foil? Because for a lot of people listening to this, they're going through this learn to downwind foil, I guess, steep learning curve. And I'm sure you've got a few tricks of the trade to share with us. And on that, I kind of want to also talk about your training that you did for your crossing as well to sort of strengthen up your legs and your cardio and for those things. So let's start with when you learned to foil and what it was like, because it's always fun hearing these.
Yeah. First things first, the very first time I tried foiling was actually in Maui. And I'm pretty sure you were involved in it as well that day with, we went down to Sugar Cove with Jeffrey and Finn Spencer. I forget if Kenny might've been there as well, but that was the very first time. Like, we were in Hawaii for a stand-up paddle competition. And I think we were just messing around one afternoon, and, you know, that was when foiling really still was underground. And, like, you know, Kai had just, you know, released his video, and the Spencer brothers were already, like, you know, jumping on it. So I remember I tried one of their stand-up paddle foil boards, and, you know, just was fucking scared and intimidated and felt like I had been riding a mechanical bull that just wanted to kill me. I think many people have that first experience with foiling, but that was the first time I tried it. And then I got a foil from Nash later that year and started playing with it at home in Denmark. That this must have been, like, I want to say, like, 2016 or something, 2017. And then, you know, I got into it and also know that our waves over here, they're not A class most of the time. They're pretty, you know, small, mushy waves, but that was perfect for the foil. And, like, I got all psyched on, you know, re-exploring my local breaks with the foil, and it was just epic. But then, you know, foiling was more just of, like, this fun thing I did when the waves were small and I was not competing. But then I think the first time I went on a downwind was 2018, like two or three years ago. And, like, I'd seen, you know, and that was kind of like the dream that, like, you know, especially Kai had promoted that in that first video that went viral, like, all of a sudden the whole ocean is a surf spot. And I don't really think I understood that until a few years later, where I did my first downwinder across one of the local fjords back at home, like an inland estuary. And it was just, it was like, I went out, because we normally do stand-up paddle downwinds across it. And, you know, I had seen people try it, and, like, I had, you know, tried pumping with my, because I think that's big of one of the mental blocks you run into, is, like, you ride a foil in the waves, in the surf break, and then you try to pump it a little bit. And, you know, you might have a little bit of success for, you know, at first, maybe like 20 seconds, 30 seconds, you can pump back out to the break. But from doing that to doing, like, a half hour or an hour downwind, mentally, it seems very distant. So I needed, like, you know, I took a couple of years building up courage. And then I went out on a day where some of my friends were doing a downwind as well. And I just remember it was blowing maybe 30 knots, 35 knots. The bumps were, you know, their shoulder high or something. And just, you know, it was massive.
Good day.
And I went out on my foil. I went out on my foil, my sup foil, and you know, I had a relatively, the biggest wing I could find at the time. And tried and, like, you know, sprinted and got the foil up. And it was just, it was nuts. It was just fucking unbelievable. Like I was flying, like, and I just, it was so hard for me to visualize prior to doing it. But then, I mean, I just literally felt like I was a bird flying across this big piece of water at speeds that I had never experienced before on a stand-up paddleboard.
Awesome.
So it was kind of, it was a long build up to actually doing it. And even in my head, I was unsure whether I actually could do it. But then once I broke the code, like, fuck, full speed, can't stop.
And so I guess from watching you from afar, you're on your SUP foil board most of the time, not a pro.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good tip for the guy. Like a lot of guys who want a downwind foil aren't necessarily SUP guys, but they, for me, the stand-up allows you to, with having a paddle, you can paddle up onto the foil so easily. And from watching, I know how good a paddler you are. You've kicked my ass plenty of times. The speed you possess would make it quite easy for you to get up and get going, I would imagine, compared to someone who maybe just started stand-up paddling. So that's a seriously, like that's a success story. You know, you learned to foil. You spent a bit of time, like probably 2 years foiling in the waves before you went and did your first downwinder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely not a bad thing in that you built up your skill set. And then, you know, I'm sure you're paddling onto unbroken waves in the surf to get going. And then you went out, used your biggest foil, which, you know, great choice, especially for your first one. And that's a lot of people fail to do. So, oh, you know, I saw James using, you know, an NL160 one time. I'm going to use that. It's like, nah, I've progressed down from like the Maliko 280. You know, I've gone all the way down. It's all the whatever it is. Using the biggest foil available. And were you linking up waves like 2-for-1s, 3-for-1s, or before you went did your downwinder?
Yeah. Well, I was probably at a point where I could link 2 or 3 waves together when surfing and, you know, pump back out. And I mean, like in retrospect, I think I could have gone into the downwind earlier. But it was very much mental because no one in Denmark was doing it at that point. And I was only seeing like these exotic videos of, you know, Hawaii and you know, you guys in Australia starting to do it. So, and I think it just was mental very much. But then again, like once I broke the code, I realized like, you know, it as well to downwind foil on a SUP board, it's not the act of actually flying that's the problem. It's taking off, like, you know, getting the foil airborne. And I've helped quite a few people here at home now, and there we have a great, you know, group of people that do foil downwinds now regularly. But you know what kind of is what I see is a common denominator is that it's people that are fairly skilled stand-up paddlers are having the easiest time getting going downwinding on a foil, because just, you know, just the explosiveness you got to possess to do those like 15, 20 sprint strokes really fast to get going is alpha omega. So that's what I've tried to help people with that wanted to do downwind foiling is like, well, let's work on your stand-up paddling sprint skills. Because that's really, and I think many people will be capable of doing it. It's just you gotta kind of maybe break it down and into compartments.
Yeah, you gotta put the time in, and like a lot of it's like it is for sure power, but I also feel like it's a lot of technique too. And that getting your speed before you try to get lift is one thing you really gotta think about, because a lot of people they try to get lift straight away, and they're only going, you know, 4 or 5 kilometers per hour, and the foil doesn't lift until it's, you know, 8 or 9 minimum. So what I've always recommended is work on your technique in the flat, like, you know, somewhere that's controlled so you can actually find out what's working and what isn't working, and then go out like an onshore beach or, you know, an onshore bay and paddle into the wind, turn around and just work on your paddle up with a bit of wind at your back and a bit of bump at your back, because that's going to control things a little bit better and you're not gonna get stuck, you know, 2 kilometers into a 10 kilometer downwinder. But I guess what you did sounds perfect in that, one, you knew you had the paddle power, two, you knew you could link waves, three, you'd done lots of SUP foiling, four, you used the biggest foil, five, you had the 35 knot day of days downwind. Yeah. And went with people.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think that's the way to start. It's kind of like when it's, I use the analogy of kite surfing or windsurfing as well. It, in some sense, it is actually, it's counterintuitive, but it, if you have stronger wind, a lot of times you will have more power. And it's that fear of like when you're learning something new, like you don't want to be overpowered, but you still need a sufficient amount of energy to make it happen. So like on a kite, like I would rather fly overpowered a lot of times because that's, it allows you to do more, but that's just personal experience. But I will say like, it's amazing. Like with the new foils coming out, like, you know, the people are, you know, all the brands are building foils that are more efficient and still fast. But compared to what we learned on, you know, some years ago to do this, like I feel there's been a lot of steps forwards, you know,
yeah,
to making flying more easy.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I've yes and no, I think like there's definitely, the foils are definitely getting faster. I think the...
True, yeah.
But the foils are also gliding better, so once you're up it's going to be easier. But in terms of paddling up, or even, you know, I've progressed from the original Maliko to the now the NL series and the PNL, and I wouldn't say the new ones are easier to get going by any means. I'd actually say the older ones were easier to get up onto the foil, but the newer ones are faster and easier to link bumps.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Yeah, because if you take a novice on the highest aspect, you know, most racy foil, that's it's fun once you're up, but damn, it can be hard getting it there.
Getting up. And then like the stall speeds are getting higher and higher because as you want to go faster, you are then, you know, your bottom speed is getting quicker. So you have to be able to paddle up to that speed to get foiling. And like you said, once you're up and going, happy days, but it's getting going that can be really tricky. And I think, you know, well, what you did and what I recommend is biggest foil for your first downwind run, the biggest one you can get your hands on. I don't care if people say, oh, you won't be able to keep up with the swells, you won't be able to keep up with this or that.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. If you can paddle up onto the foil, you're going to have consistently, then you're going to have way more fun than going on a foil that you may or may not be able to paddle up. You haven't really tested it. And maybe this day it's 35, this is the day I'm going to be able to paddle it up. But you're at risk of wasting the conditions and, you know, better feeling. I compare it the hare and the tortoise. You can be the hare and get up and shoot off, and then you have to stop and rest and control. Or you can just be the tortoise that always can get up and going, little glide. Maybe they're going to come down, but you can get up again. You're consistently moving down the coast. Or stop, start, stop, start, stop, start. And it's no fun.
Yeah. No. Did you ever do any downwind races on the foil?
Yeah, I've done a couple now. Ben Tardrew, we did the Doctor. And so that's from Island to Perth. But the problem in Western Australia is there's so much seaweed, like ribbon weed. It's like it's thin, like this cable, but it wraps around your foil. Yeah. It acts like it's like slowly pulling the handbrake on, just like inch by inch. And it just means as you're going, you're like, oh, it feels great when you first get up. And then all of a sudden a bit of weed's like, oh, what was that? You look down, you can't see anything. Oof, what was that again? You see a little bit of weed on it. So that race, Ben Tardrew beat me and it was the hare and the tortoise. I was on a faster foil, but I was catching more weed. Mm-hmm. So every time I would hit it, I'd stop and pull the weed off and then get going again. Whereas he would just he was on a slightly bigger foil and he could foil with the weed on his wing and his mast. So I stopped four times and he just powered through the whole time. And we were about 30 seconds apart at the end. But it was a cool race. But I haven't done many. I did one in Maui and that was fun. But I was on too slow a gear. It was a bit of an arms race, that one. And then just as it's starting to blow up, COVID hit. So it's I'm really excited to get into some foil racing. But for the time.
Yeah, I have the same. I'm excited for it as well. Because, I mean, it's that, like the kind of like the turtle and the hare. Because I mean, I haven't done a single downwind foil race, but I could imagine it's that trade-off between you want to fly early enough, but you also want to have a high top speed. And, you know, it's just Yeah, I mean, there's so many. Just for me, it's like sitting in a cockpit and you have all these instruments you can lever.
But you can't choose what instrument. You got to choose at the start, and then when you're out there, you're stuck.
You got to commit.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
So one thing I want to ask actually is what I've found in the waves compared to downwind is when you pull off a wave and you're pumping back for the next one, personally, I find that it's far less energy between waves. Whereas when I'm out downwinding and you're on one bump and you go across to the next bump, one, it's a shorter distance, but also I just feel like there's always been more push. And do you want to, do you agree with that? Do you want to explain it a bit more? Or?
Well, based on my extensive research across Kattegat, I feel, there definitely is, I mean, I think the way to look at it is the energy, the water molecules in motion, and the energy coursing through the water, where if you go in the ocean, you know, you're dealing with swell that is so, groomed, you know, it's spread apart. The energy is spread apart in these waves, 10, 15 seconds between each other. And it's just the energy is so categorized, like it's so, you know, it's organized. Mm. Where I feel like when you're on a downwind or like on open ocean in a breeze or something, you know, then you're dealing with the chaos of wind or like wave energy inside the fetch, so to say. Like that's what we call it in Denmark. Like even when we go surfing, you know, the waves are just like, it's like a wind swell just all over the place. Where when you're doing a downwind, like even if you see the bigger bumps over there, it still means that like there's still smaller bumps sporadically spread out, which I think it's kind of fun, you know, having surfed my whole life, it's still fun to now get on the foil and learn about wave energy and how like I thought I knew everything, but I realize I don't. Mm. But it's kind of, it's interesting, like, and also how the foil is able to harness this. And I think that was one of the hardest parts with this project, the Viking Crossing, because we got some great pictures and the media in Denmark wanted to understand what the fuck was going on. Like, how does this work? Yeah. And it's really, really complicated to explain to someone that doesn't, you know, understand hydrodynamics and stuff. But I just said like, oh, it's like, you know, Aladdin's flying carpet. That's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, actually, I was just watching your Instagram story or video, and you were talking about, you're in the middle of the channel, I think you're halfway, and it was getting lighter, and you were talking about how the getting going was like a 747 taking off. We need like a nice big run up and get the speed, and then once you get off, it's like good. And I think I really like that analogy that like, the energy, you know, you're taking off in a plane, the energy to get going, like you're hooking on the runway, you're going super fast, and mm-hmm. only right at the end of the runway do you start to lift. That's a really good way of thinking about it, is that you know, before you can get on Aladdin's carpet, you've got to do this, expend all this energy and get all this speed and, you know, get the power, and then only then once you have a certain speed can you think about lifting off, and then you're lifting off, and then it's that dream that everyone, you know, fantasizes about. It's this downwind foiling, these little swells, smoothness amongst the chaos. You know, you're linking this bump here, that bump there, and
exactly.
You're joining the dots. And like you said, it's chaos. I really like how you explain it. It's chaos, and it's just this, all this wind swell mess. But with the foil, it's like you're mountain biking or you're snowboarding or you're just, you know, going through the moguls, and you just every mogul, you're just getting speed down it. And I find it hard to explain to people, but that just surf foil, like, oh, I can't believe, you know, you foil for, you know, 120 kilometers. How could you do that? It's like, well, it's not like I'm just pumping around the whole time. A lot of the time I'm just gliding. The wind is at my back. The wind swell is with me. The swell is kind of with me. And you're basically just trying to link and glide and just place the foil in spots. You're not, unless you chose too small a foil or the wind dropped on you, you're not pumping the whole time.
Exactly. But that's the beauty of it. I mean, that's when the magic kicks in. When you're all of a sudden the energy that seems, you know, call it chaos, like something that you deem is not usable or not, you don't understand, like all of a sudden it has a relevance, it has a purpose. And then I look at water in a completely different way now, I think, mm-hmm. after really foiling for some years and understanding, especially from even the ocean, like if you look from oceanology or like meteorology, like it's so fascinating to like now look at the ocean differently and be searching for this chaos. Because that kind of sums it up, like navigating chaos, that's kind of what downwind foiling is.
Yeah, it's really making the best of a what would otherwise be a pretty ordinary situation. I was doing some work for Swellnet, and you know, it's a surf forecaster, and they're, you know, always looking for offshore conditions and a nice long period of swell. They prefer east swells than south swells because it fills into the whole east coast and all this sort of stuff. And I'm looking at it, and you know, you have to rate it, you know, out of 10, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is a 7 out of 10 day for most people, you know, surfers. But for me, you know, this is like a 5. And then, you know, there's windy, the southerly fronts come through, and it's just, you know, the southerly buses, and it's cold, it's windy, and it's gross. My colleagues say, it's a 1. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, it's a 10 for me, mate. You know, there's no one out, wind howling, you know, there's no one out. What do you mean? You know, it's firing out there, and it's such a cool way to, I guess, to live, you know, like every day it's pumping. And that's what foiling is to me. You know, it's always a day where it's going off. And I actually, on that, like where you live, it has waves, but they're not great waves. I'm sure you would have had way more fun days in the surf because of your foil.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's funny because we said the same thing 10 years ago, like, oh, now we have the paddleboard. Yes. Now can be on the water even more, making most of the conditions. But once again, like with the foil coming into the picture, you know, these average to shitty 1 to 2 foot days where, you know, it's onshore or like just gutless, that amount of energy, it's kind of like the iceberg. You know, you see the tip of the iceberg, right? It's kind of like you see the tip of the small wave breaking, but there just is so much more underneath the surface that we're not seeing. And like in Denmark, at least, like I'm probably foiling half of the time now, just because it's the speed. I love the speed I get from foiling. You know, you're flying faster, like you're doing these, like in the waves, you're doing these huge arcs, like as if you were snowboarding, like I'm snowboarding in deep powder or something. So it's just a completely different sensation. And I think the quality of my time on the water has only gone up since the foil coming into the picture. It's and the same, like it's nuts. Like you look out in the bay behind me now, there's so many people foiling, and not just surf foils or sup foils, but on all types of crafts. And it's just, it's funny. It's funny how like now we're all about, you know, flying above the water.
Yeah, how things have changed. Like you said, when sup came, it was the same. Like, oh, now I can surf that bank down the beach because it's not as good. There's less people, but yeah, I'll have more fun because I've got this big board and a paddle and I can catch it and I got all this speed on the wave. Now I go back to my stand-up after being on the foil and it's like, what happened to all my speed? You know, I got to get back on the foil and I can go fast again. All this drag from the sup, or, you know, it's so fun. It's sort of like, it hasn't ruined my surfing, but it definitely has changed my perspective a little bit, that's for sure.
I can relate.
I want to quickly go back to what sort of training did you do before your big 120K? Like, because a lot of people ask me is like, how do they train for the cardio strain that foiling puts on them without just going for a surf foil, you know, if conditions aren't conducive? Were you doing any running? Were you doing any gym or cycling?
Yeah, so I approached it very much like I would my regular stand-up paddle training. The kind of, you know, that involves a lot of, you know, race board paddling. It involves running. It involves a little bit of gym work, but I'm not really a gym shark. I did a fair amount of, you know, body exercises, like, you know, doing some resistance training, like paddling in headwind or adding a bucket behind my board to induce drag. But I think like for foiling, the difference here was like and maybe I could gain a lot from my sprint knowledge of, you know, dealing with lactic acid, of, you know, the explosiveness of foiling. You know, you have to be able to get her off the runway, which was the main thing. So I did a lot, in the months leading up, I did a lot of low intensity work at first. And then as I had a base, then I would start adding, you know, these interval sessions, both on my stand-up paddleboard, but actually for foiling, I did a lot of, you know, just pumping. Like I went out even on my surf or my sup foil and just like started linking rides. Like I think I would go for like, I'd do intervals of 4 minutes. Like I'd set my watch, catch a wave, ride the wave, pump back out and just keep doing those transitions for four minutes.
Yeah.
Like sometimes I didn't make 4 minutes cause I was just dead. But I think I was wearing a heart rate monitor and like, you know, from pumping, you can just elevate your heart rate and your whole system is just burning. So in terms of like threshold training, that was really good. And then like, I think it was, I just approached it like I was training for a long distance race, have adding some, you know, sprints in between. So it was, I think for me, it helped that I have 10 or more years experience as a stand-up paddle racer that made it a little bit easier. But then again, I mean, it was, but that was the fun part. It was different, like trying to crack the code. What do I really need? And
yeah. Did you do any prone paddling for the last 10Ks?
Nah, I didn't anticipate that, but you know, prone path. I mean, that was the beauty of it. Like I didn't train for it, but that was the only part of my body that was still, you know, functional for the last 10 kilometers. Like my two arms just, okay, back to it.
Yeah. No, I was just being a smart ass. But yeah, it was, that's really good insight for anyone who's watching. Casper's, there's a reason he's a world champ. He knows how to train. So someone who's looking at getting into downwind foiling, that pumping practice, and I assume Casper, you were using a lot like your downwind wing when you're doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was on my downwind, the exact setup that I wanted to use. I was just to also add the familiarization, to become familiar with the setup was key. But I mean, I think for me, it comes down to methodical training of, you know, I mean, I like to think of myself as just, you know, acting on what I feel like doing and what the conditions dictate, but you can come pretty far with, you know, methodical training of, you know, building the right blocks and putting it together.
Yeah. And I guess that talking about like building that base by you going your race sup board, you know, once you've got your base, putting in those sprint intervals, yes. And yeah, that's, you know, everyone, it's not rocket science. A lot of people are like, oh, what do you do to paddle so far? It's like, well, you just got to train low intensity to set yourself up. Once you've got that base, you can start doing a bit more speed stuff, then do a little bit of a mixture and then start to taper before you do it. And it's kind of like, it's not rocket science, but that methodical, I guess, I'm sure you'd have written it down and just being, okay, today I'm doing this. You've got to sacrifice some things that you would like to do if you want to achieve greatness or you want to achieve downwind foiling, or you want to achieve your goals. So that's a really good way of, I guess, you didn't just, oh, look, it's windy today, I'm going to go kiting. Oh, look, the surf's pumping today, I'm going to go surfing. You're going to be like, well, if it's windy, I'm going to try to make the use of the downwinder. If it's flat, go for my race board. If there's a few little waves, I'm going to take my race foil setup, I'm sorry, my foil downwind setup, and just pump around in the waves. And that's, yeah, words of wisdom. And that's familiarization with your equipment that you're going to be using for your downwinder. And this is, I guess, what I'm trying to get a bunch of crew to do and everyone to do is more downwind foilers using a SUP ideally, or if you're going to be using, you know, a prone board with paddles like Dave Kalama, you know, use that in the surf and get used to and going on that. So it's familiarization with your equipment and, you know, not using your 4.6 prone board, using the stuff you want
to do. Use the right equipment, because I think that can cut off a big chunk of the learning curve. Having the right equipment, not trying to ride the, you know, the fastest and the, you get the point.
Really, really cool. I want to finish up with two more questions. One is, wing foiling. But before I do that, I just touched on it. Dave Kalama's prone paddleboarding. I'm pretty pumped to try it out, to be honest. Have you?
Oh, yeah? I haven't tried it, but I saw Dave paddling around with, was it, I mean, it was like some paddles out on the hands or like.
Yeah.
And you better have some serious upper body power. I mean, that's a lot of area you put on your hand, but it'd be fun to try. Good experiment.
Yeah. I spoke to Dave last week and he was saying how for sure he can go quicker on a SUP version. Use the same board, use the same foil, but he's going to get up way easier using a paddle, which to me and you is a no-brainer because, and for Dave, he's a SUP paddler. There's a lot of guys that want to learn to downwind foil that don't necessarily have the SUP skills. And, you know, for me, I'd recommend learning to SUP. It's not the hardest thing to do, and probably just biting the bullet and using the bigger board and the paddle. There's guys in Hawaii. Have you seen the Voyager foilers? I'm getting one of the guys on to chat about, but they're using like little boards like this.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And little boards like this to get going, and they're just paddling into waves.
They're tiny.
Yeah, and so David, I've tried to get Dave over to be my spy and see, you know, what it is they're really doing. Are they surfing the outside swells? Because, you know, for example, they're not going to prone foil from Denmark to Sweden, are they?
No, but that's not the point. That's like that's just a nutcase.
Who would do that?
Yeah. I have this feeling when I go on a downwind on a foil that, man, I wish I could share this feeling. Like I could express to my girlfriend, to my brother, to the people around me that you got to get in on this.
Yeah.
But it's so hard to describe the feeling. It's just exhilarating and it's magical, but it's true. There is a really steep, hard learning curve.
Mm.
To get into it. So, I mean, yeah, maybe that's the question you have in your mind. Like, how can you break that down?
Yeah. Help more people to get into it. Yeah. I really want to try the hand paddle thing that Dave's doing just to sort of see if it, cause he says it's harder. So I believe him. I know it would be harder, but if it's, he's a SUP paddler, but if you can teach a prone, you know, surfer, to paddling on these big boards, and easier for them.
Well, I mean, if you have a good surfer, a prone paddler, like, you know, then comes the, if you can get up to speed and then you can get up on your feet quick enough, like that's where, you know, a quick pop up would come in handy. Like if it is a good surfer, maybe. Yeah. Well, send me a detailed debrief when you do it.
Yeah.
See if it works.
We'll have to get you on. I'll break it down. Break it down how it worked. And then the final thing I want to talk to you about is wing foiling. Have you done much of it in the waves, downwind, freestyle? What's your experience?
I've done quite a bit of it the last couple of years, you know, riding the new Nash wings. And it's more of been like a fun thing for me, like, you know, playing around. And we have a lot of really good point breaks around here. No, they're not good point breaks, but with the foil and the wing, they are suddenly good point breaks.
Yes.
And like you can just kind of cruise up to the top of the point and then you're just playing like all the way down and then you're just zoom right back to the top. I like it. It's fun. I haven't really done any competitions with it yet. Just been playing around with Polar Bear, my friend here in town.
Yeah.
But I would love to try to do some, you know, some of those slalom races where you got some zigzag courses. It looks fun. And I think the wing is a good entry for so many people to foiling. Like that's probably my conclusion as well, is it is, yeah, it's easy. It's super easy to get into and it's fun. And
probably the easiest wing sport to learn from my experience anyway. And people say, oh, it's still hard, you're foiling. It's like, yeah, but... You know, kiting and windsurfing are probably a bit harder to learn.
Yeah, that's right. There's it's all hard, but I think the wing is just, it's so intuitive. Like there's not all these strings and there's not no harness and Yeah. I think, well, after the whole Swedish expedition thing, I have not really been foiling too much recently. I've really enjoyed, you know, just the fact just holding a wing and like letting the wind carry me instead of working my ass off.
So have you been any wing downwinders, or you just been in the one spot in the waves?
I just stay in one spot in the waves. Like if I was to do a downwinder, I prefer doing it on my sup foil. Just
yeah,
that's where it's at. But like especially in waves, like today I think we have what, like, I don't know, 15, 20 knots of wind. I think I'm gonna bring the wing out and, you know, just cruise back and forth, and you know.
Yeah. It's the self whip. You can just tow yourself in. You're literally winging, you get rid of the wing in the wave, and you just foil all the way in, and you just whoop, back out. Let go.
Yeah, that's the way to look at it. The self whip.
Yeah, I love it. So much fun.
Yeah.
I have to. I'm gonna challenge you. Actually, have you seen my wing upwind, pack down the wing, grab my paddle out of my backpack, put the wing into the backpack, and then sup down the
hill? Yeah, I saw that. You did it. Was that down in, where was that? In the lake you did it?
It was just here and just out the front, just in Sydney. So I just, you know, park at one spot. Couldn't organize a shuttle, so I just winged, you know, 5Ks upwind. And then once you get 5Ks upwind, I just turn around and I just deflate the wing. I wrap it up and I put it in my bag and I grab my paddle out. So if I come down, I can paddle up and get going again. So I think that's something that could work really well in cold Hawaii.
It would, and it solves the problem of you know, when you can't find a driver for the downwind.
Exactly.
but it's a fun adventure. Like it's kind of those types of things that, how do I say it, like you just do something because the challenge part of it and the journey of it is just fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's problem solving at its finest, I reckon.
Top level. Yeah. Top level.
Okay, we're going to finish with three tips. Three tips for those guys learning to downwind foil. They're doing their first run. And what are you going to tell them? What's the first tip?
Practice sprinting on a sup in calm water. Like, improve your technique as much as you can there. Two would be, pick equipment that is suited for easy flying. Like don't pick the Formula One car, pick the nice steady VW diesel engine, you know, something that flies easy.
Yeah.
And then number three, I guess, would be, like I did, pick some solid conditions, you know, something that where you're not fighting the bottom of the spectrum, but instead there's plenty of push behind you. You want solid wind and bumps for the beginning.
Yeah, there's some great tips. You know, practice your technique, use the right equipment, and wait for a windy day. Awesome. Love it, Casper. We're going to wrap it up.
I just copied what you said earlier, so it's pretty simple for me.
Yeah, but you said it, not me, so that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I want to thank you for coming on, Casper, and it's been actually really fun catching up with you. So, thanks for coming on, and I'm looking forward to following your next Viking Crossing 4.0. I'm sure you're already planning it.
Yeah, there's something in the works. I think I need a little mental detox before I'm ready for it, but the adventure awaits. So, thanks for having me on here.
Oh, thanks for coming, Casper. And actually, we didn't even get to it, but I wanted to quickly chat to you about the Viking Midsummer Challenge. Maybe just quickly, do you want to give us a little debrief of how that went?
Yeah, I mean, the Red Bull Midsummer Vikings was an idea, and it's a stand-up paddle team relay race in Copenhagen. I started it 2 years ago with some of my friends, and you know, it's 24 hours of paddling on teams. It's just about fun, paddling in the dark, celebrating midsummer, and have some music and food along the way. It's more of a festival than an actual race. And this year, we paddled 10,000 kilometers. Wow. There's 350 paddlers on 70 different teams. And we raised, I think it was $15,000 for charity as well. So it's one of those events that, you know, I've had enough serious races in my life. And now I just love these events that, you know, celebrate adventure and teamwork and challenge. Yeah. So get over to Copenhagen next summer.
I hope I can. Actually, I'd love to come over and bring a team from over here. That'd be an awesome experience. And I just, fingers crossed, summer turns up for the challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you never know in Denmark, but we will roll out the red carpet and make you feel welcome.
Awesome. Again, thanks so much for joining us, Casper, and looking forward to catch up again soon.
Right on. Thanks for the talk.